Can't he be eliminated?
No, he's a symbol of opposition to the administration.
So?
We've done cross-sectional psych readings which show that a high percentage of people, particularly the younger ones, believe that Blake's trial was a showpiece, that his statements were rigged.
His death could be used by the dissidents. They need a hero. Alive or dead, Blake could be it.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Forget the elections. If this Tory government had any real interest in democracy, they wouldn't be smashing trade union democracy. After all, the trade unions have around 15 times more members than political parties and are far more democratic. Yet David Cameron's government are trying to change union constitutions to make their election bureaucracy so strict that the Conservatives would not be in power now. David Cameron wouldn't be Prime Minister if he followed those rules. We talked to the trade union's top barrister, John Hendy, QC, tonight. And the prevent strategy, as it rolls out once more, major problems with the new version. The government funding has been directed at Muslim areas. Why is that? Plus, BBC documentary this week about the downed MH17 Ukrainian airliner. Why are the BBC censoring their own interviews with eyewitnesses? And why is there no reporter on the documentary? Who is their star witness? The man in the warehouse, Bellingcat. And proof this week from Seymour Hersh in the US that presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton signed off supplies of chemical weapons to the Syrian rebels, which were used in the Ghouta massacre several summers ago. Again, a story unreported here in Britain. So, Martin, let's start perhaps with the story I just mentioned there about the about Seymour Hersh. He is actually saying, isn't he, that Hillary Clinton quietly signed this off, knowing exactly what was going on, that she is a war criminal for peddling chemical weapons. This goes against all international treaties, and it's a war crime.
Yeah, well, the audience needs to understand who Seymour Hersh is. He made his reputation like John Pilger in Vietnam in the 1960s. He exposed the My Lai massacre, and he's basically, he's regarded as the most senior US journalist by those in the know. He's the guy who always gets the story, always gets it right. His contacts in the military and intelligence in the US are impeccable. And of course, he's not been published. He used to be published in the New York Review of Books, but because what he's saying is so dynamite, he's basically published most of his stuff recently in the London Review of Books. But it's all absolutely solid stuff, very solidly researched. And of course, what he's now pointing out, he said all along that it was NATO intelligence services that supplied the sarin from Libya to carry out the attack at Ghouta, which killed civilians, which was to be blamed on Assad. But now he's also linked Hillary Clinton to being involved in exactly this scam. And of course, if you remember at the time, President Obama waxed and lyrical about how this was a terrible event, the worst thing that had ever happened since the Second World War, and if we didn't do something about dictators using chemical weapons on innocent civilians, it was a red line and we had to go to war. Now, what the evidence now suggests is it was a war crime carried out by NATO with the full knowledge of the US Secretary of State.
Well, I know it's actually Carla Del Ponte at the United Nations has also said same, didn't she, at the time? Just a minute, Martin, because isn't it quite possible here that Seymour Hersh has been set up with a kind of straw man story to discredit him in future?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so at all. In fact, all of this makes horrible sense when you realise that the armed uprising in Syria was coordinated by NATO intelligence services and the Gulf Cooperation countries like Saudi Arabia. They set up the war. And they have created the chaos. And, of course, it didn't lead to a quick fall. I mean, not that Libya is in a very happy state now, but they couldn't get a quick victory because Assad, basically, has got too much popular support. Not everybody in Syria supports him, but quite enough
do. It's nothing to do with that, is it? It's to do with the fact that he's backed by the Russians.
No, he's survived for two reasons. A, he's had Russian support, obviously, military support, but he's actually, they carried out a parliamentary election.
I mean, little countries now can't survive unless they've got the support of one of these big superpowers, if there's an attempt
to regime change. Twas ever thus, Tony, you know, North Vietnamese would never have defeated the Americans without support from Russia and China, obviously. But they had a parliamentary election in Syria, a couple of weeks ago, hardly reported in our media. But what was significant about that was the turnout was around 70-80%. That means that those who were alienated from the government in non-government-controlled areas didn't participate, although most of the population has fled to government-controlled areas to get away from the rebels that we've been arming and training, the kind of rebels that use chemical weapons on civilians in order to try and create an incident, in order to try and get a world war started. Those people, you know, the people your taxes pay to support. Eventually, of course, this is going to unravel. And ultimately, of course, what we're talking about is senior political and military figures in the West going to a Nuremberg trial.
Now, Seymour Hersh has pointed to a report from British intelligence saying that the sarin was used didn't come from Assad's stockpiles. Hersh also said a secret agreement in 2012 was reached between the Obama administration and the leaders of Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Qatar to set up a sarin gas attack and blame it on Assad so the US could invade and overthrow Assad. Hersh alleges that Chris Stevens, the American ambassador killed in Benghazi, was complicit in sending the gas to Syria, and there's no way his boss Hillary didn't know about it.
Well, there it is, from the horse's mouth. Now, that ought to be leading the BBC's news bulletins, but it isn't. And that's why people are sleepwalking into World War III.
Now, this agreement, which he's seen, he says the terms of the agreement, funding came from Turkey as well as Saudi Arabia and Qatar. The CIA, with the support of MI6, was responsible for getting arms from Gaddafi's arsenals into Syria. Hersh didn't say whether these arms included the precursor chemicals for making sarin, which were stockpiled in Libya, but there have been multiple independent reports that Libya's Gaddafi possessed such stockpiles, and also the US consulate in Benghazi, Libya, was operating a rat line for Gaddafi's captured weapons into Syria through Turkey. It's probably worth mentioning this is Eric Zeus at Strategic Culture Foundation in this particular version of this report from Seymour Hersh. But what about this rat line?
Well, Hersh wrote an article for the London Review books called the Red Lines and the Rat Lines, which outlined all of this stuff. Because he's got very good links. He was able to explain that both Dempsey, who was the head of the US Armed Forces of the Middle East, and Flynn, who was the head of the NSA, resigned, were pushed out because they were unhappy with Obama's policy of supporting ISIS and had actually been passing intelligence to the Syrian
army.
Hang on
a minute. Obama doesn't support ISIS. Yes. He's trying to eradicate ISIS.
That's just propaganda. Nobody in the Russian military believes that for a minute. Nobody in the Syrian military believes it for a minute. Nobody in the Iranian military believes it for a minute. And you know what? There's probably smart people in the British military who don't believe it, not least because they've been involved in helping to arm and train the people that have been ripping Syria apart.
So the only people that do believe it are the London media, is that right?
That's just about it, Tony. And that's, of course, as I mentioned earlier, because people are misinformed and given a whole diet of half-digested lies and psychological warfare operations, that's why we're on the brink of World War III. People don't realise it, but we really are on that brink because of all these machinations.
Well, where would it break out? In what way?
Well, if you're living in Syria and you've been attacked by sarin gas supplied by NATO, it's already happened. The idea that this is not going on, it all happens somewhere on the moon or in space, is just wrong. The war started on 9/11 when, as we know, it's pretty clear what the intelligence services of the world know and think about it. That was a put-up job to create exactly the kind of scenario that's unfolded. But you can fool some of the people all the time and all of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all of the people all of the time, least of all the Russian general staff, who won World War II while we were just piddling around.
Now, well, I don't think we were doing that. We were certainly fighting on our own for many years.
Well, indeed, but anyway, they were pretty much the main force involved. Let's face it.
What about the role of the European Union and I suppose particularly the French and the Germans in all of this? Because they do have this kind of unelected person who's the head of foreign policy for the EU now from the European Commission. We do think, don't we, of the US as being mostly behind this kind of stuff in the Middle East. But what's the role of the European Union? And I've noticed, for example, that the Germans have given these submarines, nuclear submarines, which can be used to launch nuclear cruise missiles, given them for free to the Israelis, for example.
Well, what you've got to realise is that the EU, whatever it's in, you know, its European roots, which do exist in the Franco-German hostility and then rapprochement, has been created as a means to extend US power into Eurasia. And basically, the EU doesn't have an independent policy. It's decided in Washington and London. And when we say we want to leave, the EU is part of this conspiracy. Yes, they are. I feel like saying to Nigel Farage, when do we get our vote on leaving NATO, so we can be like Switzerland and Ireland, just out of it?
This came up on BBC Question Time last night, and I almost felt like, oh, I can retire from my journalistic career now, because we actually heard the Bilderberg Group mentioned the first time, I think it is, ever on BBC Question Time in relation to the EU, with a very astute question from, well, I would say that, wouldn't I, from one of the audience members. We actually got the biggest round of applause of the night, so let's have a listen to that now.
Okay, you stay in the front here.
The question originally was about moral principles. Should we decide on moral principles? Neil Kinnock was rejected by this electorate, by the British electorate, on two separate occasions. He then resigned, went off to the European Commission, and took upon himself greater powers than our Prime Minister. Is it morally right that a man who is unelected and rejected by the British population then takes upon himself more power? Is it morally right that the European Commission have spent the last 3 years negotiating in secret the TTIP with the Bilderberg Group at their backing? Is it morally right that these people have power over us and we don't have the democratic right to get rid of these people that we don't want?
No, of course I can. I mean, I think you're right that Europe needs reform. And I don't think that you will find many people in the Labour Party who are arguing that we should remain that don't believe that Europe needs fundamental reform, much more transparency, much more democracy, and decisions made closer to the people that they actually affect.
Just a moment,
Isabel. I agree with you about that. But the idea that we would be able to take back more control over the things that affect our lives, whether it's climate change or jobs or terrorism or drugs or immigration, by cooperating less rather than more, is just fantasy.
Right, Isabel,
and you've got a group of people over here who are arguing about sovereignty, and they are giving away our power. And
it's going to be diluted. The more countries that come in, our influence is going to be diluted. How can you possibly think that we're going to have a greater influence when there's five more countries being touted to come up into the European Union?
Well, I think it's quite interesting that well, he sounds like a UKIPper pointing out about the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, because of course that's absolutely true. In a way, this whole vote on Brexit is a farce, because we're all supposedly going to sign up for the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership anyway.
Well, there's news
which will be decided by Wall Street.
Well, there's news this week that may not happen.
Well,
there's been
not happen.
Leaks about it, and they're saying that now that this actually the TTIP could be dead in the water.
It could, and of course when they say there's going to be these new countries entering the EU, that's absolutely not going to happen. What happens, I was involved in, I used to live in Poland before it was in the EU, and what we used to argue when I was working with Polish Socialist Party was that we don't want to go into the EU, we don't want to rush into the EU, because they will then dominate what we want to do. We want to go slow and do things our own way. But the idea, you see, once you've created the EU, the idea that leaving it means that you're going to then get the power you had before you went in is simply wrong. The problem is that we don't have any power. We don't have any power over the EU. We don't have any power over Wall Street. We don't have any power over the corporations which are negotiating TTIP. We don't have any power in NATO. And we just heard in our earlier conversation that MI6 were involved in procuring sarin to kill civilians in Syria. Now, what control do we have over that? Not a lot. And ultimately, of course, if people want freedom, when they claim they do, then you've got to be prepared to sacrifice for it. And ultimately, I will vote to stay in the EU because I can't see any good reason to vote to come out, because the idea that we will get back our sovereignty if we vote to leave the EU is fatuous in a world run by gangster capitalists.
So you've just completely given up, haven't you?
No, Varoufakis... No, I haven't given up on democracy. What we've got to do... Varoufakis said you should vote...
His point is that EU is run by failed politicians.
Europe is run by the corporations. Those failed politicians are simple... The European Commission is a civil service role. It's not an elected role. So they choose people. My friend Laszlo Andor became a European commissioner.
But they're talked about as the government, and they are effectively, for example, a foreign policy minister that goes around the world is one of the commissioners.
Yes, indeed. And the commissioners take their orders from Washington and London. That's why, for example, France and Germany did not want to go to war with Iraq, but we went to war with Iraq, and now they can have the refugees, even though we started it. Now, of course, we wanted a war in Ukraine, and we got a war in Ukraine. It's been an absolute mess for the German economy, as four former German chancellors are well aware. We started that war. That's made a mess for Germany. Oh, but we want out of the EU. Now, what's going to happen now, as the banks collapse, because we're going into a full-on capitalist crisis?
Brexit might help that. Mightn't it?
Where Brexit may lead simultaneously to the breakup of the EU and the breakup of the United Kingdom as Scotland votes differently
from
Britain.
Well, I'm talking about financially, the
Eurozone. Oh, yes, and the Eurozone. And then everybody can go, yippee, we've got what we wanted. By voting for Brexit, we've pressed the button on crashing the entire capitalist system and we're all off to war with Russia, even though we carried out the sarin attack.
I mean, isn't your attitude rather a bring it on attitude?
At this stage, do you know what I really want, Tony? I want Brexit to go through in England, but for Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland to vote to stay so that the United Kingdom is brought to its knees. And, of course, if the banks have to go down, it might as well be on a timescale that we control.
What's the point of bringing your country to its knees?
No, I don't want to do this. I'm going to vote to stay in. What I'm going to say to the people who vote to go out, and of course there will be consequences if we go out, very, very serious consequences, I am then going to beat the people who voted to go out over the head with a rusty hammer for the next 20 years and all the consequences flow through.
What I'm saying is, for the last however many years on here, you've been saying, well, look, we're putting this off, we've got to deal with this financial situation. Surely Brexit is going to force that to happen.
No. Brexit's an irrelevance. It's rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Meanwhile, as all these big social forces are at work, capitalism is imploding, China's collapsing, the war in Syria, we started it, we carry out the sarin attack. What's happening on the passenger deck in southern England is that Tory voting voters are sitting around in their deck chairs arguing about whether they should be on or off the ship. The ship's sinking whether you're on or off it, but they don't realise that they're going to be they're going down with it.
Going on to the Bilderberg conference, which is interesting, taking place in Europe again. Normally they swap backwards and forwards between the Europe and America. They seem to have given up on that these days, maybe because of the protests would be too big in the United States. Is in Dresden in June. I think I better turn your microphone down, Martin. You're snorting there. Ground zero, actually, of bad Allied practice during World War II, Dresden, isn't it? It was a bit of a massive, many people say a war crime, 25,000 mostly civilian deaths in Dresden.
Well, I mean, it's a sad part of our history. Nobody, even people who think that strategic bombing was justified, can take pleasure in the deaths of 20,000 civilians. We ought to have grown out of all of this, but clearly we haven't.
Also, it's also ground zero for the present-day German far right, with Frauke Petri and Pegida chief Lutz Bachmann are also from Dresden. Interesting.
Well, we're now moving into a situation horribly reminiscent of the 1930s, where economic failure leads to political paralysis, followed by war and mass movement of refugees. We're there. we've arrived.
Well, actually, funny you say that, because I've just had a look at a caption or a newspaper article in Germany. Germany's Pegida chief, Lutz Bachmann, poses as Hitler with the caption, "He's back!" The leader of the far right-wing anti-immigration group has since deleted his Facebook profile after that was copied and discovered.
Well, look, all of these things are bubbling away, aren't they? And the idea that by Britain voting to leave the European Union, it's you can't leave institution. We do all of, we as the,
it's
as
the Hotel California, is it?
Yeah, you can't. You can't. We are going to have to work with other forces in Europe to bring this criminal oligarchy to heel. We won't be able to do it on our own. We've got a big role to play because the City of London is their headquarters.
Well, for many years, the Dutch
but we're going to have to take them on.
For many years, the Dutch set up a thing called the Campaign for a Different Europe, which had chapters from all over Europe, which was campaigning against the EU.
Varoufakis is pushing very much the same idea. We're going to need a European-wide anti-capitalist struggle.
But, I mean, even David Cameron has tried to reform the EU. He's come back with nothing.
Yeah, but his reform was to make it... do you know one of the reforms he was pushing is less regulation of the banking sector? That's what he was pushing. That's what we need, isn't it? Less regulation of the banks so they can carry on ripping us off blind. Fantastic.
Okay, so any more thoughts about the location of the Bilderberg Conference in Dresden in Germany? Why Germany? Germany is also ground zero for power in the EU, isn't it?
Well, I mean, all of these ghosts from the 20th century are coming back to haunt us, you know. The creation of the State of Israel, deals between Zionists and Nazis, neo-Nazis on the rampage, intelligence services actually encouraging neo-Nazis on the rampage, because as we know, the Dortmund Beer Hall massacre and various other assassinations...
Well, more recently than that, in Brussels, for goodness sake, the Brussels police just allowed a whole bunch of neo-Nazis to go charging into a peace vigil without stopping them, letting them walk past.
Yeah, well, underlying all of this is manipulation by intelligence services. So they basically create the Islamic extremism. They've created it. It's pretty much their creation. They also then create the right-wing response to Islamic extremism. And meanwhile, of course, behind the scenes, what we're dealing with is criminal gangster oligarchs. That's what we're dealing with.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com. And leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Well, the BBC Conspiracy Files is back. Did a Ukrainian fighter jet shoot down MH17? The BBC documentary claims a Boeing 777 may have been targeted by another plane. But these headlines, as usual, Martin, with the Conspiracy Files and this chap, Mike Rudin, who we've had dealings with before, it's completely misleading because, of course, they tried to really just divert attention away from that possibility using this chap called Bellingcat.
Well, indeed, and he's you see, what they've got, this is so-called open-source journalism. This guy, Bellingcat, as I understand it, was a redundant computer programmer, and he started going online every day in his house, looking at the kind of weaponry that was being used in the Syrian conflict, and then he just managed to leverage himself into being an expert on the Syrian conflict. It's a bit like the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is constantly quoted by the BBC. That's a guy working from his attic in Coventry of Syrian extraction.
Well, his name is Elliot Higgins.
Yeah. Oh, and Higgins is the Bellingcat guy.
Yeah.
Not the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. That's somebody else. Now, these people are then touted as independent journalists like me and thee, but in actual fact, they are mouthpieces for intelligence service propaganda, basically.
Have you got any evidence that he's not just who he says he is?
Well, no. Well, he can be who he says he is and still be an agent of influence. That's what he is. I think the MH17 stuff, we can go into detail on that. Do you know what? The Americans still haven't released their satellite reports. Kerry claimed that the satellite showed, without a doubt, that the attack was carried out by a Russian Buk missile. And the Russians said, well, come on then, show us your satellite reports. And they haven't, because you know why? Because they haven't got any. My best copper's hunch, having looked into it all, about what happened, is that it was shot down by a Ukrainian fighter jet, which various eyewitnesses said they'd seen. They were actually interviewed by BBC Russia. and then the whole thing was suppressed.
Well, I've got something to add to that, because the very footage you're talking about, yes, it was disappeared by BBC. I think it's called BBC World Service that looks after that. It's part of their budget that does BBC Russia. The individual reporter had her report taken off the BBC website just a few days after it was broadcast. And it's all in Russian with I think she's a former Latvian reporter.
Yeah.
And the eyewitnesses were saying, oh, yeah, we saw a fighter jet chasing this plane. Not only that, is I thought I'd give it a go, and so I put that particular bit of footage this week up on YouTube. Guess what? BBC World have ordered it to be taken down.
Well, what a surprise. Now,
most of the rest of the world, you can watch this stuff, but not in Britain. What, wonder what's going on there?
Well, because just like the fact that we started the war in Syria, that we carried out the sarin attack at Ghouta, and that we shot down MH17, we are... the fascist barbarians.
Our licence fee payers' money. Actually, no, I think BBC World is paid for out of the Foreign Office. Although, I'm not sure, it may be now licence fee that the government have forced them to use the licence fee to pay for that, is being used to issue legal notices to take down factual stuff the BBC have gone out and shot, because it's embarrassing to them to see that their own footage is not being used by the Conspiracy Files programme. So that seems incredible to me. The BBC have got this explosive footage of their own, and yet they don't show it in their own documentary.
Well, I mean, we're being manipulated. To carry out a thought experiment, if there really is a criminal oligarchy in charge with gangsters and secret service agents running around the place trying to fix everything, you can be pretty sure they're trying to fix the media while they're on.
Well, the absolute top-notch site on Bellingcat is Wikispooks. So if you go along to wikispooks.com/wiki/Bellingcat, you'll find a fantastic amount of information about him. I mean, for example, on 23rd of August 2014, Bellingcat made an estimate of the exact location where the James Foley ISIS execution video was made, and yet he failed to notice the video itself was fake.
Well, there you go. I mean, what we've got, I mean, a key component in all of this is Rita Katz's site website, searching internet for terrorist entities. And she's the one that's broken a lot of these ISIS videos. You wouldn't, why does she get hold of all their videos first? Extraordinary. And ISIS seems to have a very, very kind of savvy media arm. They've got their own monthly glossy magazine, which you can actually read online.
And the evidence presented in the programme didn't include some of the most explosive evidence. It's not on July the 19th, Kiev's security service, this is just after the downing of the airliner, the SBU published photos online that it claimed showed Russia secretly withdrawing a book /M surface-to-air missile system from the Ukraine civil war zone. However, bloggers immediately pointed out the photos were of a Kiev air defence system.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the only Buk air defence systems in the area were those of the Ukrainian military. The Russian military, don't forget the Russian rebels in Donbass and Luhansk are basically a dad's army militia. They wouldn't know how to fire one of these complex pieces of equipment, even if they had one.
Now, I noticed also that there was no particular producer that actually... Mike Rudin had done the entire programme himself, written, directed it and everything, and there wasn't an actual reporter on screen. For these conspiracy file programmes, they don't seem to like the idea of using a reporter. Now, from a professional journalistic point of view, this is an absolute no-no. You don't have a mystery person behind the scenes whose name you can only see in the credits. In fact, what he did is he used the actress Caroline Katz, who's a drama actress, to do all the voicing. There was actually no professional journalistic side to that at all.
And she's got the same surname as Rita Katz.
Yes, spelled with a C, though, not a K.
Ah, okay.
she's an actress doing a documentary. Yeah. What on earth is this? It almost sounds, if you start to drill into it, it almost looks as if this is blatant manipulation.
Well, what they are worried by the existence of things like Russia Today, where all of the issues that we talk about are discussed openly in a rational way. That starts to undermine their power.
And what about
the BBC's role is to spread as much...
Never even mentioned.
...smoke and mirrors as possible.
Never even mentioned, as well as these interviews the BBC themselves had in their archives, still have, I imagine, unless they've been destroyed, it is the tapes of the air traffic control. control, because this plane was mysteriously diverted downwards and towards the war zone by Kiev air traffic control. Then, I suppose one of the big smoking guns for me is they interviewed Yatsenyuk, who's the president of Ukraine. One of the questions...
Prime Minister.
Yeah, and one of the questions that the families of the victims of that airliner desperately want asked is why, 3 weeks after that disaster, was the defence minister Andrei Pereiby mysteriously sacked by him? No question was even asked of the prime minister. What was all that about? Because many of the families are looking at it and thinking that's rather suspicious. Why did you sack your defence minister without any explanation? In fact, he himself said, "I'm not going to say why I've been." Removed, and he's now Speaker of the Ukrainian Parliament, Pereiby.
Yeah, well, the other thing I'd mention to add to that is that the black boxes were recovered by, you know, in the areas controlled by the rebels, and they were passed to Moscow and then passed to the British, and then they've disappeared.
Well, the British have still got them. There hasn't been any proper report, or certainly something that's able to be peer-reviewed. The other thing to point out about Pereiby, of course, is he's a neo-Nazi.
Yes, well, he's recently been in Canada and in the US canvassing support. He is a neo-Nazi, and he looks as if he was behind the Odessa Trade Union Hall massacre, etc. But these people are working in cahoots with our intelligence services, so let it not be forgotten, we now have evidence we're involved in gassing civilians at Ghouta in order to try and win their war that they started in Syria. These people are not nice people, but they're paid for by our taxes, and at what point are we going to do something about it?
Well, good question. Overall, the Conspiracy Files has looked at all sorts of things, 7-7, 9-11 several times, the death of Princess Diana. It does look as if the whole idea of having kind of balanced documentaries is completely out of the window. Is there anything we could do about people like Mike Rudin, apart from, I mean, I've had conversations with him, phoned him up at the BBC and said, basically, what the hell do you think you're doing, putting out this propaganda? Is there anything we can do to bring back a kind of golden age of balanced journalism? Because it almost looks as if these big TV networks are now being used to only show, each one only shows its own side of the story.
Well, the fact is that there's two sides to this. Yes, this kind of manipulation is becoming more and more egregious. But the fact is that it can also be exposed. And it could well be that if we get the exposure right and in the right kind of... And the balls line up, that all these scams that they've been engaged in will come back to bite them in the bum. My hope.
One place that this documentary is certainly not going to go down well is in Holland, because they actually recently had a referendum of some sort, didn't they? A vote on whether to... isn't it to rubber stamp the some sort? What is this agreement?
There's an accession agreement between the Ukraine and the EU. There's no promise that they should join the EU, because it's actually virtually impossible to imagine how you can arrange it. Integrating Greece has turned out to be quite a difficulty. Integrating the Ukraine is completely bonkers. But it's actually very disadvantageous.
What about Turkey?
Well, that includes Kurdistan, of course, so we'll just have all the Kurds as well, at least for the time being. This is an absolute mess, obviously, a mess of our own making. And, voting for Brexit really is a hopeless response to, you know, we go around the world setting off these bombs politically and socially, and then we want to come home and have a nice cup of tea. And I'm afraid that's not the way the world works. I often say to people who supported the war in Iraq in 2003, you said you wanted it. Now you're going to pay for it.
Much was made in the documentary, the fact that this Su-25 fighter, which some are saying could have actually fired a missile from it, an air-to-air missile, to bring down the plane or hit it with its cannon. It's got a powerful cannon, which could have been aimed at the cockpit. In fact, many people have pointed to holes in the wreckage, saying actually that does look like a cannon has been fired into the cockpit by another aircraft. Much was made in the documentary that this plane can barely reach that altitude, but we've got two other potential bits of evidence which weren't explored by Mike Rudin. One is the possibility, well, first of all, the fact that the air traffic control ordered the plane to come down, so it may have been that they were already at that stage thinking about trying to shoot the thing down, and also there's the fact that the plane actually came down, didn't it? It actually did move down, and it moved closer, and also, of course, there's a very, very basic thing that they didn't even consider, and that is that it's possible that the plane was a little bit lower, maybe 1,000 feet higher as an airliner, and it fired at it from there.
Well, indeed, that's quite right.
A missile can easily
the other smoking gun is that they haven't followed normal procedure in the investigation.
Indeed, they haven't, have they?
They've just made it up as they went along from the get-go. And they've even signed an agreement with the Kiev government that nobody's going to agree what the story is about what happened unless everybody agrees, including the government in Kiev, who are, in fact, suspects.
OK, so nothing's going to come out of those poor families, honestly. It really is a hideous. The other thing that happened, I don't know if you know about this, but the pilot's body, when it was brought back to delivered back to Malaysia, it was done. A deal was done where we said, "Okay, you're not allowed to say anything without our permission. Then we'll give you the body back." I mean, this
But they were also allowed to carry out a post-mortem on the body. They weren't allowed to do that because, of course, what that shows probably is that the guy was shot.
You mean with cannon shells from the aircraft? Goodness gracious. Anyway, horrendous to think that this sort of stuff is still put out on the BBC, that Mike Rudin still got his job. Absolutely amazing when we consider that the brilliant documentary tradition we've had over the years in this country at looking at both sides. I mean, he really is taking the mickey, that chap. So let's move on now, Mark, just look at the thing I mentioned at the top of the hour, which is the trade union bill. This is rather an attack on trade unionism and the... What do you make of the massive, much higher number of members of trade unions here in Britain compared to political parties, and also the fact that they're actually far, far more democratic than our own political party?
Well, as an active trade unionist, I'd say that's a rosy picture. There's a lot of members of trade unions, but they're not very active, and political...
Well, Isn't the same with political parties?
I mean, what's happened with political parties is that they've grown quite a lot smaller, but the smaller base tends to be more active. Trade unions have an awful lot of members who don't do very much, but I'm an active trade unionist. I want them to be successful organisations. And of course, as you pointed out in the first hour, there is a real question mark over whether the government, representing corporate interests, should be sticking its finger into internal elections of what are civil society organisations. Is it the government's role to tell the Church of England how to run its stuff, for example? The answer is probably no. Why is it the government's role to tell the trade unions how to run their business?
OK, well, let's have a listen now to one of the leading barristers, QC, for many trade unions, including the National Union of Journalists, and that's John Hendy on the trade union bill.
I'm John Hendy, QC. I'm standing counsel to the NUJ and several other unions, and I've been following the progress of the trade union bill very closely. It's a really fundamental attack on trade unions and on collective bargaining. I suppose the centrepiece of it is an attack on the right to take industrial action, imposing new turnout and threshold requirements, placing new obligations on pickets. And beyond that, they're attacking the political voice of trade unions by requiring members to opt in to paying the political fund levy rather than to opt out, and they are going to block in public authorities deduction of union contributions by the employer, even where the trade union has agreed with the employer to do that and pays the employer to do it. And they're also going to restrict facility time and give new powers to a state official called a certification officer.
And is this a sort of licensing of union democracy by the government?
I wouldn't say it was a licensing of it. It's just putting up a series of hurdles that are going to make it more difficult for unions to do what their members want them to do.
When it comes to doing ballots, for example, we've got used to this over the years, that it's not just a show of hands, it's a postal ballot normally. What are the new conditions on those ballots?
You're right. The requirement currently is a fully postal ballot, which means the union's got to send out the ballot paper by post to the member's home, which means its records must be up to date, and the member has got to fill in the ballot at home and put it in a stamped, addressed envelope supplied by the union, post it back to the union or to the scrutineer in order for it to be counted. That requirement is also supplemented by the obvious requirement that the ballot must be a show of majority in favour of taking the industrial action. What this bill is proposing is that there must be at least 50% of the members in the balloting constituency who actually vote as well as there being a majority of those who do vote. There's a further requirement in so-called important public services, health, education of the under-17s, transport and so on, and that requirement is in those industries there must be 40% of the balloting constituency voting in favour of industrial action, as well as a 50% turnout, as well as an overall majority in favour.
That's a pretty steep order, considering, for example, in the police and crime commissioner elections, that we had some places where not a single vote, some polling stations where not a single vote was cast in that polling station.
Absolutely right. And in parliamentary elections, of course, in the last government, only obtained about a third of the votes that were cast, which represented, I think, 24.6% of the entire electorate voting in their favour. So their democratic mandate to introduce these democratic requirements is non-existent.
You have a fairly wide view of this, working through several different unions. So what are the actual implications? If this legislation does go through, what will it actually mean in the years to come?
It's going to mean that industrial action, which takes place lawfully now, will not be able to take place lawfully in the future. Some unions, in some disputes, will be able to surmount these hurdles. But I think one of the things that is an unintended consequence of this legislation is that it's going to become so difficult and so burdensome that members will take matters into their own hands and simply walk off the job without any ballots at all. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that so-called wildcat action, direct action by employees.
Now, I know you've also been working on the blacklisting. Okay. Just bring us up to date with how what's been going on with that.
The current state of play is that we're now in the middle of April and there is a trial scheduled to take place in May, the trial being the blacklisted workers bringing claims for conspiracy, breach of the Data Protection Act and so forth against the construction companies that set up the blacklisting organisation, which they called the Consulting Association, which was in existence for the best part of 40 years and blighted the lives of hundreds and hundreds of construction workers all over the country. There were 3,200 names on that blacklist when it was finally raided by the Information Commissioner. So the current state of play is that many of the workers have been offered and accepted sums in settlement, but there is still a good number of outstanding claims which currently are, as I say, are scheduled for trial, conceivable that they might be made increased offers before that.
Well, the most significant thing he said there, to my mind, is he talked about wildcat action. That's what will eventually happen if it becomes impossible for unions to organise ballots and have strikes. If people want to express a grievance, as they do in France, they'll just walk off the job or even occupy the factory. And if the union's not directly involved, they can't be sued. And therefore, the employers then will have nobody to talk to. Because that's the thing about that kind of strike. I remember what happened on the Underground years ago, and because of all this legislation that was already on the books, some of it. And the drivers on the Underground just got together in the Roundhouse in London, banned anybody else from coming in, and they all threw a sickie on Monday morning. And of course the employers could have sacked them all, but then who's going to drive the trains on Tuesday? And there was nobody to negotiate with.
Effectively what this means is a slow process here, but outsourcing the having to deal with strikes and industrial disputes to the police, because they're effectively saying, well, we want we will have to allow the police to allow scab workers in, and also to stop organised trade unions doing what they want to do in pickets and things like that. So, I mean, it's a bit like what's happened with the making squatting in residential homes illegal. Private landlords have just said, well, we want the police to do this job for us. Then it's the same is happening with employers.
Well, it is, but ultimately, working class got to fight, and they will. What Britain was famous for before, in the 50s and 60s, was that people didn't get onto the union. If they didn't like something, they walked off the job. And, of course, it wasn't the union would then be brought in to try and persuade them to go back to work. That's what people forget about this. Unions don't go around fomenting strikes. A lot of the union bureaucracy spend all of their time trying to prevent strikes. And, of course, if they make the union bureaucrats' job more difficult, which is what they're doing, then they won't be in a position to use those union bureaucrats to stop strikes when workers finally had enough and walk off the job. You know, if all the junior doctors agree to walk off a job, then there's nothing anybody can do about it, not the British Medical Association, not the government. And that's where we'll go. And that's the kind of industrial relations that they have in France as well, where people just go out on a general strike. They don't even, not even members of unions, right? We're all on strike tomorrow. Off they go. It's the kind of thing that used to happen in Poland in the 1980s. It's the kind of thing that used to happen in South Africa. It's the kind of thing that happens because, as I say, it's the kind of thing that happens in China all the time, because working class got to fight.
Now, we actually had a clip from it a few weeks ago when we had our mayor's debate, or was it the Police and Crime Commissioner? I can't remember, but it's Naila Ashraf from Manchester Stand Up to Racism. Spoke to her recently about this whole prevent strategy, Martin, because we've had a whole new version of it rolled out. But the thing is that it's largely secret. For example, when children at school are being investigated by the police or by head teachers, etc., often the children and the parents don't know anything until they get a knock on the door from a constable. So let's have a listen now to the full interview with Naila Ashraf from Manchester Stand Up to Racism.
My name is Naila Ashraf and I'm part of an organisation called Stand Up to Racism. I want to speak to as many people, and particularly trade union activists, about how they can help support the fight against racism.
Tell us about this prevent strategy. A lot of people have heard it, but it seems to be almost something that's behind the curtain, behind the scenes.
It was a strategy that came out under the Labour government under Tony Blair at the height of the anti-war movement, and last year the present government basically tightened it up and basically said every public sector worker has to report anything they see that may be suspicious. What it basically said is, we want you to spy on the Muslim community. That's how it's seen. That's what the training is for. And they talk about extremism.
Hang on, because it's not actually aimed at the Muslim community specifically, is it?
But it talks about dealing with extremism, and it touches on other things, a very tiny bit about fascists and stuff like that, but actually the core of it is about the Muslim community. And if you talk to people, they will say that the funding is very much connected with the amount of Muslims you have in that area. So it's a case of, as a public sector worker, whether you're a teacher in a primary school or a secondary school or a university lecturer, or you're a council worker, if you come across something that you think is suspicious, and it could be as small as somebody wearing one of these badges, a political badge, or it could be somebody saying something in school. So for instance, we've had an example of a young boy in secondary school talking about eco-terrorist, and then a week later being visited by the police and asked whether he supports ISIS. And I think what it's done is it's created an atmosphere of suspicion. Public sector workers are being asked to be an extension of the police. And I don't think they're particularly racist at all. I mean, it's not the role of the teacher to point the finger at the Muslim student. But I think the way it's been rolled out, and I think even when the training is good, because of the wider implications in society right now about the Muslim being the other and the threat of Muslim extremists, as if that's the worst thing we have to deal with within society, people do feel they have to do something. And at a time when they're fearful for their jobs, and because they're being told that this is part of the law, they're just, you know, reporting anything. And at times when in the past where they would have, you know, thought twice about something being an issue, or taken the child to a side and had a conversation, rather than doing that, they're just going straight to the police. Their whole families are being investigated and visited and, you know, going for a whole load of trauma for nothing.
Well, you say for nothing, but this is actually an attempt to stop radicalisation.
I don't think it is, because what it's creating is such an atmosphere of fear and suspicion in our society that, in places where children and young people should feel safe to talk, you know, ask questions, share ideas, they're feeling they can't contribute. And in particular, young Muslim students and nations in particular, they're not taking part in debates and discussions. So it takes away the very thing that you think education allows you to do, which is have a voice, think through ideas, you know, develop ideas. You know, some of the training that's been rolled out, university lecturers are being told to look out for young students who may change the way they dress or their group of friends. Well, that's the kind of thing you do normally when you go to university. Yet now it has a different connotation to it.
Can you give us some examples of sorts of behaviour that are now reportable, and maybe even specific examples of things that have been reported?
I've talked about the young man in secondary school who talked about eco-terrorism, you know, and about environmental issues, and he was pulled in a week later and asked whether he supports ISIS. There's been situations where a young child in primary school has written a story about his weekend, and he talked about living in a terrorist house. He meant to write terrorist house, and rather than the teacher correct him, she went to the police. this is the example of what's happening. There's another situation where I've personally been contacted by a teacher who had been told in his school that he had to spy on a young girl. He's a teacher in a primary school, and apparently the police were investigating an elder sibling in the family, and they thought that she might be at risk of being a terrorist as well, or being radicalised. This is a child in primary school, and the teacher's clearly concerned, but what do you say in that situation?
The trouble is, of course, much of this would be happening behind the scenes. The people involved wouldn't even know.
No, they wouldn't, and that's the problem. We're getting told by the police that 80% of referrals are actually things that they don't even look into. But because they've managed to create such an atmosphere and climate of suspicion and fear, that public sector workers are reporting all sorts of things. Because there's no real definition. What is extremism? How do you identify whether someone's at risk of being radicalised in the future? I mean, you're basically saying it's a thought crime. You're reporting a thought crime or a potential future crime. It's just crazy.
Also, looking around the north of England, particularly over the last couple of years, there have been several racist murders of Muslims, usually connected with a mosque of some sort.
Yeah, and we hear very little about that. And yet, constantly, the Muslim community are being told that they have to do something about the problem within our community, about terrorism, about stuff that's happening at the end of the world, as if we have some responsibility for what ISIS do. I mean, I don't know whether the government understand this, but as a Muslim woman, I can't really pick up the phone and tell ISIS to stop bombing. You know, but maybe if they change their foreign policy, you know, it might change what's happening on a global scale. But to blame Muslims as a collective is so racist and, you know, criminalising all of us.
Now, there's a lot of people on the left that support, for example, the Palestinian cause, which is kind of attached to Islam. I wonder if you think there's any kind of connection between the left generally and this prevent strategy.
So I think presently it is focused on the Muslim community. That's quite clear. But there's no doubt that this is going to affect other organisations, other groups that are fighting back. I think what it's going to do in the long run is stop dissent. Stop people from speaking up against the government, because let's face it, it's not just about the Muslim community. There's been situations where they've used the legislation around fracking, they've used it around anti-racist campaigners. You know, I've got examples of young students in secondary school handing out leaflets about Unite Against Fascism demonstrations, which are legal demonstrations which have been agreed by the police. And yet, I know a particular young person who's a 15-year-old who was then put on the prevent under the scheme. He had a 2-year de-radicalisation programme for handing out anti-racist leaflets in the secondary school.
There have been some demonstrations around fascists and anti-fascists about the way that, that these have been being policed and the reaction of the police to this and how that fits into prevent as well.
So I think it's disgusting that the police would think that the way they police both the racists and the anti-racists are the same, as if we're the two sides of the same coin. It was quite clear from the MacPherson report that actually you can't treat racists and anti-racists the same, and yet the police do that. And if anything, they see the anti-racists as a problem. They would be quite happy if none of us came out and demonstrated against the racists. And some people would say, when you see these demonstrations, that the police are in somehow protecting the racists, because they are. They're allowing them to march up and down our streets. They're allowing them to use language, you know, that would incite violence against a group of people, and you don't see many arrests. And yet, on the other hand, we've seen these 12 young men in Rotherham that are being arrested for basically defending their community, standing up against racists, something that the police should have done in the first place. And yet 12 Asian men are up in court for this.
There's quite a lot of campaigning now going on around actually turning things around and start, I suppose, bringing the authorities to their senses a bit.
I'd like to think the authorities would come to their senses. It's crazy. They know what they're doing. I've had so many people say to me, particularly in the Muslim community, well, if we explain to the police just how damaging this policy is, or if we explain to the Tory government just how bad this, they'll somehow change what they're doing. They'll change the policy, or they'll disband it. I don't think that's the case. I mean, I think the government clearly know what they're doing. They know what they're doing when they attack the Muslim community through this legislation, just as they know what they're doing when they cut back on the NHS funding. You know, it's an attack on the way we live, the kind of society that the British working class have fought so hard for. But I do think that the tide is turning, and I don't think it's because of the politicians or the authorities come to their senses. I think it's because people are getting themselves organised. As trade union activists are getting organised, the NUT, their motion at a conference was absolutely fantastic, standing up against the prevent policy and standing up for the kind of society we want to live in.
I wonder whether you, as a Muslim, feel persecuted by this, almost like it's like a kind of social bullying.
So I think it is. I mean, I'm quite lucky because I'm very active and I have a good network of people around me that are very political, and we see what's happening in a political way. But I know lots of friends, young women, who will say, well, I don't want to watch the news, it's really depressing. You know, you don't can't open a newspaper without there being a story about Muslims. When you hear something, the first thing you think is, oh, please God, don't let it be a Muslim who's done it. Because we all feel responsible. As if we're all the same, one big lump of person. And yet at the same time, we're also the ones that are highly threatened by what's going on. So when Cameron makes his speeches about Muslims need to be more integrated, it's women like myself who are visibly Muslim, who wear the scarf, that are at threat of being attacked on the street as I walk home from work, or, you know, sit on a tube.
Is that threat real?
I think it is. I know so many women that have talked about it and who will talk about not using public transport anymore, especially since what happened in Paris.
Whereabouts do people go to get a good analysis of Prevent? Because this is something which, as I say, people's children may be being subjected to this at school without them even knowing.
So there are lots of organisations, and unfortunately a lot of them are charities that are campaigning in this area. And I think the thing that we need to do is get organised as trade union activists and get the weight and the strength of the trade union movement working in this area and working against this policy, because that's really where the strength lies, I think.
How do parents get educated on what is going on behind the scenes at their schools?
I think there are lots of campaigns. They need to be going in, talking to their teachers, talking to the schools out there. You know, there are governors that should be raising questions. We shouldn't just accept this as a given. We can push back, but also on campuses, they've got campaigns such as Students Not Suspects, which is an absolutely fantastic grassroots initiative. We've also got things like MEND, which is a Muslim organisation, campaign against this stuff. So there's lots of grassroots organisations coming up, but I think they do need support, and I think we all need to work together.
Naila Ashraf then, from Stand Up to Racism in Manchester. Martin, pretty pernicious stuff this, but look, we're in the middle of the election count here. All this stuff will come out in the wash in the months to come. Everything happening, although it doesn't seem to be publicised very well, if at all, at Summerfield House in Whitchurch on Whitchurch Lane, now known as Parkview, which is some giant privatised complex. Wonder who's doing the private security for that tonight. I hope that the parties are keeping an eye, a very, very firm eye, on those ballot boxes and all the ballot papers. Very strange to privatise it. I think it should be basically being looked after by the council and being done much more quickly. Also, to let you know, Sue Mount-Stevens, today it's been announced, has been re-elected as the Police and Crime Commissioner. The Independent, who was on this show last week, was it? A couple of weeks ago? Can't remember quite when. The Mayor is being announced tomorrow, and the council councillors on Sunday. For some bizarre reason, Bristol's behind the whole of the rest of the world, even though we're supposed to be a high-tech city. You can find this show online at thisweek.org.uk. Follow me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Join us for the politics show at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.